Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
The Wicked Witch of the West is her diametric opposite, angular and shrouded in black. She greets us in a cacophony of screech and caw. She is a woman inflamed, a creature of fire and desire, with her libidinous laugh and hard-on for scarlet slippers. Her movement isn't float, it's flight. Arrow direct forward motion, broom between her legs, leaving a trail of smoke behind. She is living singe. All freedom and speed and scorch. Even at the beginning of the film, in her guise as her doppel, the mean Miss Gulch, she rides a bicycle, a rather independent activity for a woman of the 1930s. Unlike her rosy-hued, hermetically sealed counterpart, this witch feels the air on her skin as she rides. But she is also a thonic character. Queen of an upside-down underworld, living in a gray castle on top of a mountain range that resembles a row of jagged teeth. The Wicked Witch's skin is a lurid green, evocative of poison and envy and plague. Her pea pallor and overall color palette tell us that she is a sickening deliverer of death. Ironically, the character of the Wicked Witch of the West was most threatening to the actor who played her. The green makeup was copper-based, and as the Oz Wiki says, potentially toxic, and it could only be removed with alcohol, a highly painful process thanks to its antiseptic sting. It was also difficult for Hamilton to eat anything while in costume, and she had to ingest mostly liquids or else have her food broken into little bits and fed to her by a production assistant. Several sources say that Hamilton's skin stayed tinged green for weeks after the filming was complete. Even more harrowing, her costume caught on fire while she was shooting the Munchkinland scene, leaving burns on her face and right hand. She had to miss 2 months of filming to recover. As it is so often with witches, the line between villain and victim was smudged with soot. Still, Hamilton seems to have had a deep appreciation for getting to play such an iconic role. In fact, she reprised it several times later in life, including in a 1976 episode of Sesame Street, which only aired once due to complaints from parents, as well as for a 1980 photo shoot by Andy Warhol that he incorporated into a print for his 1981 Myths series. Kids who might have cowered from her in 1939 grew into adults who applauded her. One can find audio online of her and Judy Garland appearing together on the Merv Griffin Show in 1968, nearly 30 years after The Wizard of Oz was released. In the clip, Garland is quite charming, but it's Hamilton and her raucous ornithological cackle that gets the biggest audience response. There's an old English word, kench, which means to laugh loudly. I could listen to Hamilton's kenching all day. The Wicked Witch of the West is shrill, no question. And even more perverse, she revels in her shrillness. And it's perhaps this that makes her so beloved. She's frightening, yes, so much so that chunks of her dialogue got cut after the film previewed to an audience of terrorized children. But more than that, she seems to be having an absolute ball. Even when she's melting, she is living for herself, making proclamations about her own beautiful wickedness. Her actions are condemnable, but I'll give her this. She has no shame and no remorse. And this kind of wickedness strikes me as immensely appealing. That witch is one brazen broad. There is a clip that surfaced online recently of a 72-year-old Margaret Hamilton appearing on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in 1975, and I haven't been able to stop watching it. She enters his house clutching a sort of bowling bag-shaped purse and her famous pointy black hat. She is wearing pearls and a pink-striped suit. The semiotic choice of this, the Wicked Witch in Glinda Pink, thrills me to my core. Mr. Rogers guides her gently to the plaid sofa, where she perches with her hands folded like a foreign dignitary, beaming. "I'm interested to know about how you felt about playing that Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz," he says. Margaret Hamilton. "Well, I really was very thrilled. I had done it very often when I was a little girl at Halloween. Lots of children would rather be a witch than almost anything else. There are lots of other things you can pick out, but that's the one I loved. And so when I had the chance to do this, I was very, very happy about it." Fred Rogers. "Girls and boys like to play witches, don't they?" M.H. "Yes, they do. Yes, they certainly do." F.R. "And when you feel as if you'd like to play something a little bit scary, a witch is a fine thing to play." M.H. "She has lots of things about her. I've always felt that. Sometimes the children feel that she's a very mean witch, and I expect she does seem that way. But I always think that there are two things about her. She does enjoy everything that she does. Whether it's good or bad, she enjoys it. But she also is what we sometimes refer to as frustrated. She's very unhappy because she never gets what she wants, Mr. Rogers. You know, most of us get something along the line. But far as we know, that witch just never got what she wanted, and mainly she wanted those ruby slippers. Because they had lots of power, and she wanted more power. And I just think that sometimes we think she's just a mean and very bad person. But actually, you have to think about her point of view. That it wasn't as happy a time as she wanted it to be, because she just never got what she wanted." The entire exchange moves me. Rogers treating Hamilton with such reverence. Hamilton speaking about her witch of a lifetime with a deep sense of compassion and, dare I say, love. It's her reframing of wickedness that resonates with me most of all. There's no question that the Wicked Witch of the West is the antagonist of the Oz story. She is a murderess and a tyrant, and many of her actions are nothing short of evil. But her unbridled enjoyment, rubbing up against her unquenched appetite for more, 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 is what really makes her character spark. And both of these things, female delight and female desire, are so often demonized. We call witch any woman who wants. Margaret Hamilton and I are far from the only ones who have considered the Wicked Witch's side of things. I was 14 when Gregory Maguire's novel, Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, was released in 1995, and I immediately fell in love with it. The idea of bringing this odd, emerald-colored Ozian out of the cesspool and into the center of the story appealed to my own underdog sensibility. I wanted to know more about this magical footwear marauder. Maguire's first trick in Wicked is that he gives our witch a name, Elphaba, an homage to L. Frank Baum's initials. After casting this seven-letter spell, he then transforms her from a generic villain into a fully fleshed-out protagonist, with nuance, motivations, and an entire backstory. We learn that she is the child of a rape, that her mother is a drug addict, and her adoptive father is a zealot, and that her green skin is a source of deep shame and disgrace throughout her life. However, she is also a gifted scholar and a defender of the oppressed. She becomes a civil rights champion on behalf of talking animals who are being discriminated against and treated like second-class citizens. She suffers unbearable losses. Fierro, the love of her life, is captured and most likely murdered during a police raid, and her sister, Nessa Rose, is crushed to death by the house that Dorothy inevitably twists in on. McGuire's revisioning of the Wicked Witch's story becomes one about politics, persecution, and personal pain. It asks us to consider the factors that can turn a good guy into a big bad. I related to this when I read it because I too felt perpetually misunderstood, and I welcomed any story that treated social rejects with tenderness and compassion. This retelling of the witch's tale evidently hit more nerves than mine. It was adapted into a critically acclaimed Broadway musical in 2003 and went on to win 3 Tony Awards. And it continues to be one of the most successful shows in history, surpassing $1 billion in total revenue in March 2016 and becoming Broadway's second highest grossing show in July of 2017, trailing only The Lion King. Wicked is also being developed into a non-musical television show by ABC and a musical feature film by Universal Pictures. Soon, the whole world will get to sing along to the Wicked Witch's lament. Feeling like a freak, an outsider, or misunderstood is, ironically, a pretty common experience. We watch the witch with great interest because some part of us wants her to win. After all, we too fear being crushed, drowned, vanquished by the Alpha Dorothys. Each of us harbors a secret wish to be spotlit and adored, warts and all. There is another aspect of Hamilton's appearance on the Mr. Rogers Show that's significant too. It's clear that they both intend to allay the fears of the many children who found the Wicked Witch of the West to be the stuff of nightmares, to render her relatable and more human. Mr. Rogers asks her if it was hard work to make The Wizard of Oz. She says yes, then goes on to describe the difficulty of wearing the green makeup all day, and how she went to great lengths to make sure it wouldn't come off even when she was eating her lunch. She also expresses her dismay that she frightened so many kids. M.H. Sometimes, Mr. Rogers, I'm a little unhappy because lots of children are quite scared by her, and that always makes me feel a little sad because I don't think any of us thought, you know, that it would be as scary as sometimes it seems to be. But when you understand her, when you realize it's just pretend and that everybody can do it, you can do it. Little boys, as you say, do it. Little girls do it. And sometimes when you get older, you play at Halloween time that you're dressed up as something else. FR. And all witches don't have to be bad either. A bit later, Mr. Rogers asks if she'd like to try on her costume again. Hamilton agrees, saying she'd love to and that it would be fun. He opens a trunk and begins taking out pieces of her infamous black outfit. When she sees the garments, her face lights up. "Oh my, how nice! Yes!" she exclaims and begins to dress. She puts her skirt on and ties it, then pats her hips. M.H. Look at here, something to put things in. Even witches have to have pockets. FR. It's helping me just to see you get into these things. MH. Oh, I'm glad. FR. To know that you're a real lady who got dressed up to play this part. He helps her put on a black blouse with billowing sleeves, then asks her to turn around so that he can show the back to the viewers. This is a real zipper back here, just like the zipper on my sweaters, he explains. She spins back around, now dressed. There, they say in unison. She giggles. Isn't that fun, she asks. "You look great," he says. They are obviously both a bit giddy. She puts on the cape and gives it a swirl. Then she fixes the iconic veiled hat on her head and smiles to the camera. "Now there's your old friend, the Wicked Witch of the West," she says with a chortle. At Mr. Rogers' request, she does the voice and the famous cackle. He says it would be fun to talk like that, and he tries to imitate her, cackling back. "You can," she exclaims. "They all can. You can do it too." It's clear they're getting a kick out of each other. Mr. Rogers then asks if she has grandchildren. She says she has 3 and recounts their names and ages and remarks that she's very lucky to have them. The segment ends with her still in costume, leaving to visit one of Mr. Rogers' friends. M.H. "I'll go just as I am." F.R. "Oh, you will?" M.H. "Is that all right?" F.R. "Oh, that'd be fine for the neighborhood." M.H. "I think that would be fun." And they say their goodbyes. She ducks under the doorframe to accommodate her towering headgear. "There I am," she remarks, and exits the set. The first few times that I watched this clip, I was overcome with emotion. So much of it touches me. The admiration they show each other, these legendary rulers of their respective imaginary neighborhoods, the unapologetic joy they take in the Wicked Witch's scariness, the mix of pride and vulnerability of Hamilton now nearing the end of her life and returning to a part she played 4 decades earlier with respect and pleasure and grace. But what moves me most of all is the delicate dance that she and Mr. Rogers do of trying to diffuse people's fears while still not robbing the witch of her magic. Yes, they tell us, it's just pretend, but it's also real and accessible to you. And isn't that the most wonderful wizardry of all? It's a similar position I've found myself in repeatedly throughout my life. This posture of simultaneous revelation and preservation of mystery, of letting myself be scary while still having the urge to reassure others that I'm no threat. This resistance to fixing myself to any one pole. So often we try to classify, to put one another into distinct labeled envelopes and then seal them shut with the flick of a tongue. We resist nuance at every turn, and that goes tenfold for women. They are prudes or sluts, passive or pushy, babes or bitches, harlots or hags. If you show interest in fashion and beauty and sparkly dresses, you are considered vapid, a lightweight, and dismissed or discredited. If you voice your opinions or ambition or talk too often or laugh too loud, you are domineering, thirsty, a harpy, a nag. Perhaps the greatest gift that L. Frank Baum has given us is the vision of a full technicolor spectrum of female power. Yes, I'm a good witch and a good person, but I also embrace complexity. I intend to wear a black cape over my proverbial pink gown, to laugh too loud and get real mad and defend myself and the people I care about. I want more out of life than to float gently along in a bubble. I want to wear the pointy hat and the crown, to live as vividly as I can, as I am, to be wicked and winsome and wild and whole. I want to be more than either or. But my heart's true desire is to live in a magical land that values all of it. The goodness of Glinda, the glee of the Gulch Witch, the artistry of Margaret Hamilton, and the promise of Matilda Jocelyn Gage. To call that place home. Chapter 2, Teen Witch, Spellcasts for Outcasts. Sabrina Spellman didn't have a last name for the first 34 years of her existence as a pop culture character. Blonde, mod, and mischievous, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, as she was originally called, first appeared in Archie's Madhouse number 22 in October 1962. I hope you didn't expect to find me living on some dreary mountaintop, wearing some grubby old rags and making some nasty old brew, she says, lounging on the floor with records and magazines surrounding her. No, we modern witches believe life should be a ball. Besides, soft, gracious living doesn't reduce our powers one iota. She goes on to tell us that witches can't cry, they can't sink in water, and they mustn't fall in love, else they risk pissing off Della, the glamorous head witch. Inevitably, this third detail proves especially problematic for boy-crazy Sabrina. To complicate matters, per witch tradition, she's supposed to do hexes and mean magical pranks, but she just can't resist using her powers for good. Sabrina helps her friends with their romantic entanglements, decorates her room in cheery colors, gets local townspeople out of scrapes. Sometimes her spells work, but more often than not, they backfire. She'll accidentally target the wrong person, and even her jinxes end up having unintended happy consequences. I've got to try to be a bad witch, and not disgrace the family, she says to herself in a June 1970 appearance. A new hitch is introduced as the series progresses. No one can know her true identity, not even her boyfriend, Harvey Kinkle, a sweet klutz whom her Aunt Hilda can't stand. Throughout the series, whether in the comics or subsequent television shows, Sabrina finds herself torn between obeying authority and following her heart. She often longs to be a regular teen, at times wishing her powers would leave her entirely. Sentiments like these hint at the pathos shared by so many teen girls as they are caught between the desire to conform to one's social group and the need to establish oneself as an independent young adult. These conflicts proved to be far more resonant with readers than Sabrina creators George Glatter and Dan DiCarlo originally imagined. I think we both envisioned it as a one-shot and were surprised when fans asked for more, Glatter is quoted as saying in 2007. Due to popular demand, Sabrina became a recurring character in the Archie's Madhouse and Archie's TV Laugh-Out comic book series, as well as appearing in several animated TV shows. Eventually, she became the star of her own spin-off comic book series in 1971. Setting the template for generations of teen witches to come. The tone of the early Sabrina comics is light and low stakes, a projected fantasy by male creators about what a teenage girl would do could she do anything. She makes magic pizza, saves a music festival from being shut down by grumpy old townsfolk, finishes her homework in record time, and of course, tries to make boys fall in love with her. But she's also a product of her age, evolving with the styles and mores of the times. In April 1971, she's enlisted by her groovy older cousin Sylvester to help him spread the word about the New Witch movement. He turns up to the house on leave from Salem U, wearing a fringed leather jacket and bell-bottoms. All I'm trying to say is that us magic cats of today don't go around scaring people in those crazy Halloween suits, flying on brooms. That's from the old establishment, he proclaims, echoing the sentiments of the flower power generation and zapping Sabrina's go-go style into hippie chic. The Sabrina character has reincarnated several times over since then, with each iteration becoming more complex and showing more nuanced understanding of the teen girl psyche. While her love life remains a concern across generations, As time goes on, her most pressing issues become about reconciling her identities as a witch and a high school student and learning how she can exercise her powers more effectively. I first became familiar with her when I was 15 via the 1996 sitcom Sabrina the Teenage Witch that was created by Nell Scovell. It starred Melissa Joan Hart from the Nickelodeon show Clarissa Explains It All, and it ran until 2003. The show is upbeat and goofy in tone, with a laugh track and plot lines about magical mix-ups and spells gone wrong. But unlike in the early comics, 90s sitcom Sabrina is given a backstory. Her father is a witch, but her mother is mortal, making her a sort of hybrid between the magical and the mundane. She's also given the Spellman surname. Scovell named her after a real-life family friend, Irving Spellman, making her a more fleshed-out, relatable character. This series starts off on the night of her 16th birthday, when Aunts Hilda and Zelda discover Sabrina asleep and levitating above her bed. Her powers have just activated, they tell us, and it's time for them to tell her who she truly is. Being a witch isn't easy. We watch Sabrina try to learn how to cast spells and use magical ingredients, and at first, she's not so hot at it. She accidentally turns a mean cheerleader into a pineapple and causes school mayhem when she uses truth sprinkles in her home ec bundt cake, causing a candor epidemic. Throughout the series, she navigates mishaps of love, friendship, and family, and she struggles to learn when it is appropriate to use her powers and how. The 90s Sabrina show is a female coming-of-age story with dimension, if a doggedly cheery one. No matter how challenging her problems are, supernatural or otherwise, she and her aunts always come up with a solution in the end. In the 2010s, all of the Archie gang went through an edgy revamp, with the additions of social media scandals and plenty of sex. They've also been given a much more sinister vibe, thanks in large part to writer Roberto Aguirre Sacasa, who introduced the undead and other occult elements into Archie's world with his Afterlife with Archie series. Riverdale, the hit CW TV show that Aguirre Sacasa developed, has reimagined the Archie story as a sort of Twin Peaks for teens, heavy on the drugs, mist, and murder. He and artist Robert Hack have also given Sabrina a far more mature tone in 2014's The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina comic series, which was adapted into the hit 2018 Netflix television show of the same name. This latest Sabrina has some elements from prior versions. We find her again with a 1960s aesthetic, an homage to her mid-century roots. As in the 1990s sitcom, Chilling Adventures also hinges upon her 16th birthday, when she must choose whether or not to have a dark baptism and become a full witch in the Church of Night Coven, like her father was. In this more adult spin, however, we also learn that she can't be defiled before the ritual, despite her devotion to her sweet and hapless boyfriend, Harvey. Sabrina's aunts are flesh-eating witches, and her initiation into their coven consists of her having to sign the Book of the Beast and commit herself to serving Satan whenever he calls upon her. She will also have to renounce her relationships with Harvey and her friends. When it comes time to make her choice, she waffles, realizing that the Church of Night is just another hypocritical institution that peddles freedom while keeping its members subservient to a male overlord. This new rendition of Sabrina is conscious of equal rights issues, with concerns about feminism and social justice worn proudly on its sleeve. When their gender nonconforming friend Susie is bullied by a bunch of jocks, Sabrina and her pals start the Women's Intersectional Cultural and Creative Association, or WICCA, a club at school with a mission to fight gender discrimination, racism, and censorship. It is also by far the darkest version of Sabrina we've seen yet, with a watercolor wash of horror and intentional nods to such occult thrillers as Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist. The depiction of the cannibalistic Church of Night Coven is satirical, to be sure, skewering early modern Christian beliefs about satanic witches, but there's enough blood and impending doom to make the series feel genuinely unsettling. This Sabrina isn't bothered with decorating her room or getting straight A's. She's too busy drowning her sexist principal in a flood of spiders, raising zombies, and exorcising demons, both real and metaphorical. Adolescence is its own special horror show, and so it makes sense that the witch turns up in so many allegories about youth. Seemingly overnight, our social groups stratify, our identities are taxonomized, and we find ourselves in a tyrannical dominion of in-crowds and losers. Popularity becomes a new standard to be measured by. Some of us are wanted, some of us are worthless, and most of us are worried about our place in the pecking order. It's also a time when we begin to feel divided inside, wishing to be singled out as special and longing for belonging at the same time. We try to establish ourselves as individuals and begin to bear the weight of other people's opinions of us. We're consumed by crushes and lust, and we ache for reciprocity. The demands of our familial responsibilities begin to chafe against our platonic or romantic allegiances. And on top of all of that, there's added pressure to get good grades and be good looking. For many of us, to be a teenager is to be a literal misfit. You don't fit into the right community or clothing. You don't feel comfortable in your own skin. Puberty is arguably one of the most ghastly physical changes we go through. We fall subject to the body's awkwardness, its seething wants, its sudden betrayals. The teen body is a body on display during a time when so many of us would rather remain out of view. It inconveniences us, embarrasses us. It turns us into objects of judgment and desire. It is a liminal entity, stuck between childhood and adulthood, suddenly wanting to be adorned and adored. It shifts in size and shape and functionality, and there is nothing we can do to stop it. A transmogrification in real time. Though there is no question that teenage years are difficult for most people of all genders, the cis female pubescent body has its own specific markers of new breasts and new blood. We're warned that these things will appear, and that it will be sudden, that we'll have to acquire special items to accommodate our new forms. We're taught to mold our chests appropriately in preparation to be seen, but that menstruation must always remain hidden and that it will hurt. And if we engage in sexual activity, there's a good chance we might do it too soon or not soon enough, and that sex is going to really fucking hurt, quite possibly with tearing and yet more blood. We're told about other girls, older girls, who were humiliated or harmed. We lean in close and listen. Ghost stories around a cafeteria table. Whispers three times in a bathroom mirror. The teen girl becomes aware of eyes on her. She is an oddity, a spectacle, and so she trains in the art of allure, the art of defense, the art of transformation. Fairy glamour in the form of eyeshadow and contouring can disguise her infinite insecurities and roiling wishes. She learns that the attention her body receives will be weaponized, that she has power, and that power can be wielded. The combination of physical changes swelling hormones, and a newly emerging labyrinth of social taboos often causes feelings of helplessness, hauntedness, or being halfway human. No surprise, then, that young women flock to stories about witches. These tales enact this tension, rendered more romantic thanks to the added luster of magic. These shape-shifting characters provide a potent metaphor for teen girls' own rapid fluctuations, as well as their fantasies about gaining control at a time when they have anything but. My family moved to a nice town called Morganville for the schools. From kindergarten through 10th grade, I got a solid education there, and I know what a rare and lucky thing it is to grow up somewhere that is well-resourced and relatively safe. But one of the rotten byproducts of a commuter town with good schools is the classism that permeates the social scene. There were kids in my grade who lived in McMansions and who would be offered a choice between a BMW or a nose job on their 17th birthdays. These were kids who wore the right clothes, the definition of which would change year to year, from Umbro shorts to Samba sneakers to hypercolor t-shirts to Z Cavaricci pants, which you knew were real because of the white label on the fly. For girls, hairstyles evolved from huge jersey bangs, which I sported for years in a tumescent sticky crown, to locks straightened with a hot iron into strips of gleaming fettuccine. I was well-liked enough at the start of seventh grade, even briefly accepted by the popular kids. But my interests in making art and having deep conversations made us quickly part ways. My braces, frizzy hair, and flat chest certainly were no help. I drifted through different circles, not quite fitting in anywhere, too sensitive for the stoners and too strange for the straight-A'ers. I felt rootless and lonely. As I moved further from the in-crowd, my clothes got darker, looser. I raccooned my eyes with black eyeliner and wore talismans around my neck. A key, a crescent moon, a brass bullet shell with the Nicole Blackman poem Daughter rolled up inside, mezuzah style. My wardrobe was a way to stand out and swathe myself in shadows at the same time. I was turning into something else. I floated away from middle school's social nucleus and withdrew deeper into a world of my own crafting. Unlike Sabrina, I didn't join a coven or go through some elaborate initiation. My earliest experiments in doing my own teen magic were based on whatever I could get my hands on in the suburbs. Mall witch is a phrase that's bandied about these days with derision, but that's what I started out as. In Monmouth County, New Jersey, the closest suppliers of any sort of witchcraft material were the occult sections of mall bookstore chains like B. Dalton and Walden Books. If I was lucky, I would get my parents to drive a bit farther out to shops like Red Bank's Magical Rocks or Mount Holly's Ram 3 Metaphysical Books, which is where I got the idea that I wanted to be a metaphysician when I grew up, as evidenced by games of MASH I recently found scrawled in an old notebook. If the occasion was super special, I got to go to the witchcraft mecca that was New Hope, Pennsylvania, where I would buy books like Raymond Buckland's Advanced Candle Magic and my first set of tarot cards, The Sacred Rose Deck by Joanna Gargiulo Sherman, which were drawn to look like medieval stained glass. My parents were cautiously supportive. Artists themselves, they encouraged my individuality and were happy to see me pursue my interests as long as I kept communication open with them. But at school, my interest in magic remained a largely private and solitary pursuit. I wasn't ashamed of it exactly. My discretion arose from an urge to protect one of the few precious things that was mine alone. When you're a weird kid, you learn to put guardrails around the things you love. You keep them hidden, heart deep, lest someone try to take them, mock them, or co-opt them out of cruelty or just plain clumsiness. I spent a lot of my spare time writing poetry, reading, and painting pictures onto which I'd glue craft store oddities and scraps from vintage science books. We had two VCRs at our house, and I rigged them up so I could make VHS mixtapes of music videos I loved, or supercuts of every moment in a movie where the moon makes a memorable appearance. But when I wasn't making art, I was making magic. Most of my early spells were focused on the boys I had crushes on, desperately hoping to make them love me back. I also started doing occasional castings for a few trusted friends who were pining for people who might or might not be pining back. There was the spell I did for Rebecca, my sister's friend, who was hiding in my room during a house party after she told me she was lusting after some hot guy who was downstairs. I lit some candles, did some incantations, sprinkled her with some love powder that I'd bought at a New Age shop, and sent her on her way. They made out that night. There was the spell I did after spending hours picking out the perfect crystal at East Meets West, a mystical goods shop in Monmouth Mall. I came home and charged it with love magic, and then gave it to Keith, a ruddy-faced boy who was playing the role of the king in our school's production of Once Upon a Mattress. This attempt was not so successful, as he largely ignored me throughout the run. Not every spell was benign, though. During eighth grade, there was a girl I loathed. She was a rich little twit named Tiffany, who represented everything I stood against. It was bad enough that she was vapid and snotty, but to make matters worse, she was dating Mark Fleischman, a boy I was in love with. Something had to be done. I had a book of medieval magic that contained some darker workings than what I was used to. Its spells listed ingredients like toad's feet, black eggs, and freshly tanned leather. I was going to have to improvise. I found a spell entitled "To Seek Vengeance Against One's Enemy." I didn't have the bladder of a chicken, but I did have a Ziploc bag. I didn't have raw sugar, but I did have packets of Sweet and Low. I followed the steps as best I could in the kitchen one night when my parents were out. I mixed the ingredients together on the stove, adding cinnamon, garlic powder, black pepper, and a yearbook photo of Tiffany to the boiling water. I dropped in a piece of pleather that I'd cut from an old purse and pricked 9 times with a pin, per the book's instructions. I spat in the pot. I pictured misfortune befalling her. I said her name. The next morning, Tiffany showed up to school covered with boils. She had laid out in the sun the day before and fallen asleep oiled and foiled. Her skin was an outbreak of sun blisters on which she had smeared some sort of greasy ointment, making her even more grotesque. She looked like a scabbed sea creature, some sort of mottled rockfish. She was hideous, and she knew it. And she was visibly upset, walking around all day with her face shielded by her hair. The spell had worked. At first, I felt exhilarated and dangerous, a righteous sense of justice. But as the day went on, a thick, mute fear crept in. What have I done? My guilt and remorse compounded the more I thought about it. As much as I was thrilled by the spell's efficacy, I hated knowing that I was the one who'd made her suffer, and I fretted about what dark forces I might have unleashed. Lying in bed that night, I was kept awake by visions of her sad, swollen face. I decided that I would never do this to another person again. Curses to curses. Hexes no more. Invariably, talk of teen witches circles back to The Craft, the 1996 film that launched A Thousand Covens. I was 15 when it was released and couldn't have guessed then what a cult classic it would turn into. Today, it's held up as one of the most influential films about witches ever made, and there's a lot to love about it. Fans often cite its deliciously 90s costumes. Chokers, dressy vests, peasant skirts with boots. And its thrilling, no-holds-barred depiction of vengeful teen girls. Many women of color have also remarked about how meaningful it was for them that one of the film's four witches is a Black woman, something that was and still is all too rare, as archetypal witch iterations so often default to white. Lastly, the film has an air of authenticity about it that most witch flicks lack. Wiccan priestess Pat Devon worked as its consultant to ensure that many of the rituals and props resembled those of her own practice. And two of the film's stars, Firuza Balk and Rachel True, had actual interest in the occult when they got the roles, and still do. Balk went on to own an LA occult shop called Panpipes for several years, and she currently sells her own magically charged artwork online. True now has a thriving tarot reading business called True Heart Tarot. In a bit of further witch trivia, there are stories about how during the shoot of the film's pinnacle seaside ritual, actual bats landed on the magic circle. Waves crashed with shocking force, and the entire crew lost power during Balk's final chant. But I digress. Many practicing witches around my age often talk about this film as being a big inspiration for their own exploration of witchcraft, and its attempt at realism is one of the reasons why it struck a chord. But there's also a lot about the craft that's problematic. At the start of the movie, we're introduced to our protagonist, Sarah, a transfer student with a suicidal past who is plagued by uncanny goings-on. On her first day at her new school, she meets Nancy, Bonnie, and Rochelle, a group of gothed-out girls who are looking for a fourth member to complete their coven. After Rochelle sees Sarah make a pencil magically stand on its point during French class, she is convinced that Sarah is the one they've been waiting for. At first, it seems that Sarah has finally found safe harbor with her sister outcasts. Together, they can now call in the four directions, something that practicing witches do in real life, albeit with variation. With their powers now supercharged, they each set about to make their personal wishes come true. Sarah casts a love spell on Chris, the boy she likes, despite the fact that he'd spread nasty rumors about her when she refused to sleep with him after one date. "I know it's pathetic," she says in one of the film's clumsy attempts to rationalize her ongoing crush on a cruel skis bag. Bonnie uses witchcraft to heal disfiguring scars on her back and make herself more beautiful. Rochelle, the film's only Black character, casts a vengeance spell that causes a racist bully's hair to fall out. And ringleader Nancy uses magic to invoke the fictitious god Manon, which results in her abusive stepfather dying from a sudden heart attack. This leaves her and her mother with a hefty sum from his insurance policy that allows them to move out of their leaky trailer and into a fancy LA high-rise. Understandably, the girls are intoxicated by their newfound capabilities. They use magic to change the color of their hair and traffic lights and to forge a deeper connection with the spirit of Manon. They also exude more sexuality as their magic grows, both in their deportment and in their personal style. As Rachel True, the actor who played Rochelle, told me, "Our skirts get shorter as our powers get stronger." Sexing and hexing become entwined, as they so often do when it comes to depictions of witches. For a time, these teens are on a joyride, emancipated from the bounds of adolescent victimhood and attracting whatever outcomes they desire. But soon, their original spells get out of hand, and Sarah becomes trepidatious about continuing to use magic in this way. Chris, the boy who now loves her, becomes a stalker. The now more beautiful Bonnie turns narcissistic. Rochelle's racist bully is seen crying in the gym shower as so much of her hair falls out that she's rendered a high school golem. Nancy desires ever more power, and after doing a dark invocation spell, her own magic turns deadly. Tensions reach a climax when Chris's witchcraft-induced obsession with Sarah culminates in his attempt to rape her, a highly fraught message by today's standards. Are we supposed to think that Sarah brought this on herself? She escapes his grip and runs to the haven of her coven, shaken and disheveled and covered in dirt. When Nancy hears what happened, she is livid. She goes to a party that Chris is attending and tries to seduce him. When he resists, she changes her face into Sarah's, succeeds, and then berates him for treating women like whores. "You're the whore," she screams, then uses her magic to send Chris tumbling out the window to his death. Sarah, now fully convinced that Nancy is evil, tries to stop her with a binding spell that doesn't work. A violent showdown between Sarah and Nancy ensues. Sarah, tapping into the goodness and power from her deceased mother, also a witch, Natch, finally defeats Nancy by crashing her into a mirror in a shower of glass shards. At the end of the movie, the other two witches attempt to make peace with Sarah. Their magic is gone, they tell her, and they're wondering if hers is still there. Sarah responds by conjuring a lightning bolt to snap a tree branch that falls at their feet, a warning that they should never approach her again. In the film's final scene, we see Nancy strapped down to a bed in an insane asylum as she babbles hysterically about Manon, presumably writhing until the end of her days. When I first saw this film as a teen, I had mixed feelings. I was put off by the fact that these teenagers' rituals resembled so many of my own. Was this the path I was walking? Was I also going to be punished by sinister fates? At the same time, there is a cool factor that the film sells, which I found hard to resist. The witches are rebels adorned in leather jackets, black lipstick, and strands of fashionable talismans. They spellcast against a soundtrack of 90s alternative rock songs and Graham Revell's moody synth meets Middle East score. "Watch out for those weirdos," a bus driver warns them in one of the film's most iconic scenes. "We are the weirdos, mister," Nancy replies over her dark sunglasses before flashing a Cheshire smile. These girls have supernatural swagger. I wanted that too. Ultimately, though, the tone of the film struck me as patronizing and a bit mean-spirited. The lesson seemed to be, don't dabble in the dark arts, ladies, or you'll get what's coming. Don't be too powerful, too strong, too much. The craft reinforces the idea that teen girls are utterly devoid of self-control or self-reflection, that unleashing their fullest potential is to invite mayhem and destruction. At one point, the proprietress of an occult bookshop the girls frequent, says that magic is neither black nor white, that the only good or bad is in the heart of the witch. I suppose Sarah is supposed to be a good witch in the end, but doesn't she use magic to hurt Nancy and the others? We're invited to admire the way these girls refuse to be victimized, but they also get carried away, just as girls always do. Better, perhaps, to just grin and bear it than to meddle in things that are beyond one's limited understanding. Check yourself before you wreck yourself.
All this wicked comes to pass, and now it's time you go. And when all evil eats itself, I'm happier, you know, to take 2 moments to collide with all the things that I've spoiled, so I can have the strength to wreak out all the insects in my soil, consuming bitterly the sleep that I hoped I deserved. This hidden deeply in the marrow of the white lines in my road, I'm here and now. You are over and out. I'm on automatic pilot, and there's no stopping me now.
Unwind from the lead in my spine. I'm done with your harness and reins. With you, you flame in demand. For good, for me, forever.
Radio was blasting in her busy head again, inviting all the voices, getting louder, swear to be her friends. And though they bickered, bitched, and scratched behind their mama's thorny back, she nurtured each and every one of them, because they made her laugh into the big blue sky, searching madness for freedom, ringing bells, seducing our forgiving nature never ends. I'm here and now. You're over and out. I am every waking moment, and there's no stopping me now.
Unwind from the lead in my spine. I'm done with your harness and reins. With you, your flame in demand. For good, for me, forever.
Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.